All right, thank you. First of all, I want to say it's a tough position to be competing against the U.S. World Cup soccer game right now. I guess it's the second half. So if you hear any events occurring in that match, just say, goal, and I'll kind of know what's going on. So anyway, I'm Ben Zorn, and this is joint work with Puruj Ratanawaraban at Kasetsart University in Thailand, and Ben Lifshitz, who is a colleague of mine in the Research and Software Engineering Group at Microsoft Research in Redmond. So today I'm going to be talking about JS. Today I'm going to be talking about JS Meter, which is a project that we undertook to measure the behavior of JavaScript programs in real web applications. So a high-level question you can ask is, why should we measure JavaScript? So this study actually follows very closely the previous talk we just saw, except instead of looking at the network behavior of these applications, we're going to be looking at the behavior of the JavaScript, the code inside the application. And, of course, the same motivations for the previous talk are true for this talk. Basically, web applications are very popular. They're increasing in use. They're evolving, as John mentioned in the opening session today. There's support for JavaScript in every browser. There's active development in all the browser manufacturers to improve the support for JavaScript. And JavaScript performance and browser performance is very important to enable new and interesting web applications. So we see a whole new host of interesting possibilities in this space, and understanding how these applications behave is very important in making them perform well and improving their performance. One of the things I'm going to point out is that right now our understanding of performance of JavaScript in web applications is based largely on benchmarks, in particular SunSpider and V8 benchmarks. And in the talk today, I'm going to contrast the behavior of real applications with the behavior of these benchmarks. So who should care about what I'm going to talk about? First of all, users should care, because the behavior of these web applications is going to enable new and exciting applications, and so it's going to change the way in which we use the web. Second, application developers themselves should care about what their applications are doing, and some of the metrics I'm going to talk about today are things that application developers should probably be looking for when they build their applications, and there should be tools that support these measurements. And finally, probably the biggest interest in this talk is going to be JavaScript engine developers themselves, because we're going to show you what's going on in these applications, how they're different than you might expect, and certainly how the benchmarks that are being used to tune these engines are different than the real web applications. So there really is a browser war going on. Every browser manufacturer wants to build faster, better browsers. And in fact, we see here a lot of the comparison being done, especially around performance in browsers, is based on benchmarks, in particular the SunSpider benchmark. Okay. So one of the things we wanted to do in the JS Meter project is look at the relationship between a real web applications, things like Bing and Google, Gmail, Facebook, etc., the behavior of these web applications and the behavior of the benchmarks. So in particular, we looked at the seven V8 benchmarks, which are available, and they're listed here. And then we chose a subset of the SunSpider benchmarks. There's about 30 total, but we picked one from each category to get a cross-section of what was going on in SunSpider. So the goals of my talk and the goals of the project are to describe how we instrumented the JavaScript engine to collect the behavior that I'm going to present. And then I'm going to talk about comparing that behavior. So a large part of my talk is going to be focused on results, okay? And we have a lot more results in the paper. We have a long tech report than I can talk about today than are actually in the web apps paper. So I encourage you to look at our tech report for the full details. And finally, I'm going to try to point out how these benchmarks, the differences between benchmarks and real applications, can mislead designers, developers of these JavaScript engines, and take them down the wrong path. One of the high-level issues here is the question of, is JavaScript just like Java? So does all the optimization we've done for Java, can it just directly apply to JavaScript, or is there a big difference? So there's two kinds of contrast. One is between the benchmarks and the real web applications, and the other is between behavior of JavaScript in web applications and, say, the behavior of Java in typical Java programs. And I'm not going to go into that in much detail today, but you can imagine that there are actually a number of interesting conclusions in that direction as well. So how do we do this? So JS Meter is a very simple instrumentation of the IE8 JavaScript engine. The IE8 JavaScript engine is a bytecode interpreter, and so it was quite lucky. We measured the execution of bytecodes, and we can count the number of bytecodes. So one of the One of the implications of this approach is that we're measuring a particular JavaScript engine. And the idea that we're trying to do is generalize from that engine to other engines. There may be cases where this fails, but in general, I'll take this offline. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail if you're concerned about some of the results with respect to its being specific to IE8. So what we did is we modified the JScript DLL. We inserted it in IE8. We visited websites, and we collected traces. And then we post-processed the traces to get offline results, which I'm going to present today. So one of the differences between our approach and a lot of browser and JavaScript benchmarking is our attempt to get past the page load performance. Many browsers and website developers are concerned about page load time, and that's one important aspect of performance. But another aspect is once you load the page and you start interacting with the website, what happens at that point? And so one of the nice things about our instrumentation approach is that we can actually look at what happens as you execute various aspects of these interesting websites. So like Facebook, we measured as someone logs in, visits some friends' pages, browses through the photos, et cetera, and we can see the behavior of the JavaScript engine across page loads. And I'll show you some results related to that. So we broke down our analysis of JavaScript behavior into three components, looking at the code and how it executes, looking at the data, how the objects are being used, and finally looking at events. And in the web apps paper, we actually had space for code and events. We didn't have space for the data. Today I'm going to present a number of results around the data, and you can find those results in the tech report. So this is a big advertisement for our tech report, but a lot of the interesting stuff is also in the web apps paper. So what do we care about code behavior? So we care about things like how big are the functions? How many functions are there? How many instructions do we execute when we call a function? How much code locality is there? What are the hot functions? And what's the mix of instructions? So I'm going to be walking through a number of results in this presentation. This is one, they all look a lot the same. This is one of them. This shows us the total bytes of JavaScript source code being executed by the real websites, which is on the left, and the different benchmarks, which are in the middle and right. So there's a big takeaway from this slide. First of all, the y-axis is source size in kilobytes, and so you can see a couple of these websites are on the order of two megabytes of code. So every time you visit, you use Gmail, you're downloading 2 megabytes, or downloading or caching, whatever, 2 megabytes of source code, JavaScript source, which is being parsed, JITted, et cetera, every time you visit Gmail. So there's a lot of work going on executing this code, and in fact, as you can see here, the real sites are very different than the benchmarks with that regard. In fact, the benchmarks show up as an order of magnitude or smaller relative to the benchmarks. In fact, here we see, oh, maybe there's a couple that have a significant amount of code. You know, that makes them sort of more representative. But we can take another view of the same data, which is to look at static unique functions executed, okay, which is another measure of how much code is actually being executed. And as we see here, there's probably 2 orders of magnitude less functions being executed in the JavaScript benchmarks than there are in these real websites. So the first big takeaway I want you to remember from this talk is real web applications have a lot of code, and it's important if you want your website, if you want your JavaScript engine to perform well, you have to deal with a lot of code. So you won't see any information about that if you just look at JavaScript benchmarks. Okay, another question you can ask is, once I start executing a function, how many bytecodes do I execute before I return from that function? So do I have a lot of loopy functions where I have a lot of code-intensive execution, or do I enter a function and then very quickly leave it, which is more like a kind of a method in an object-oriented program? So is this more like Fortran, or is it more like object-oriented code? And here we see that, in fact, the real sites average about 50 bytecodes per call. So that's, you know, that sort of looks like an object-oriented program. The V8 and SunSpider benchmarks, unfortunately, many of them have tight loops that execute for a long time. They're very compute intensive. It's convenient for benchmarks to execute a loop a million times because it makes it run longer. It's easier to get timing results, etc. Of course, if you specialize your JavaScript engine to run these well, then it's not going to tell you a whole lot about what happens on the real sites. Okay. One outlier. Yeah, let me mention that. One outlier here looks like, well, maybe there are some real websites that actually have a lot of computing going on. But in fact, what happens here is we drill down a little bit, and I think about 80% of the total execution in this particular site is in this particular method, and what it's doing is it's looking at every element of the DOM, and it's doing basically a test on the element to see if it has a certain property. And you know, there are a lot of elements of DOM, so if you put a loop in and you do that frequently, you will execute a lot of code. However, there are probably much better ways to do this in a real web application. And in fact, one thing to point out here is there's a difference in the quality of web application developers. So some of these sites, so for example, I would say Google, Gmail, et cetera, have really, really good developers. They know exactly what they're trying to do. I would say The Economist probably doesn't have your first. Now, I hope there's no one from The Economist here, but I mean, at least from this particular behavior, we sort of walk away saying, yeah, maybe they could have done that better. Okay, another important takeaway, fraction of code executed. Here we're looking at, of the total code downloaded, what fraction is executed at least once? And we see a big trend here. So, for example, in every single one of these benchmarks, well, every one but one, less than 50% of all the code actually gets executed. So we download it. A lot of times we're going to parse it. We're going to actually JIT it, perhaps, even, if we're aggressive at our JITing. But, in fact, we don't execute it ever. That's not true for the benchmarks. Again, the benchmarks typically are designed to be executed. It doesn't really make sense to throw a lot of code into a benchmark that never executes. Of course, maybe it should, and I'll talk. I have a nice result from that later in the talk. Okay, so that's it for code. I have other results. I don't have time to get into them. There's other things to talk about. Now let's talk about object allocation behavior. So this is interesting because, again, if I'm an implementer of a JavaScript engine, I'm going to care about things like how many objects do I have? How much memory is it going to take? What happens when I do garbage collection? What kind of garbage collector should I build? Okay, and so we look at things like allocation, the types of objects, how long they live, what the composition of the heap is, et cetera. The first metric is total bytes allocated, a very good characterization of sort of how data intensive these applications are. We see, on the case of the real sites with the interaction sequences that we had, on the order of 10 to 15 megabytes, so that's a significant amount of data. It's not a huge amount of data. It's not like a typical, like a very data intensive Java application would have. We see a range and variety in the benchmarks, but in particular, this is an important takeaway, a significant number of these benchmarks don't allocate much data at all. They basically, you can think of them sort of as static C programs. You start them up, they have almost no allocation, and then they quit. And this is very unusual. Almost any object-oriented program you write is going to have a certain amount of data allocation, so this shows you how unrepresentative these are. Splay is actually very data-intensive. I guess some people use it as a metric for seeing how well their JavaScript engine garbage collector works. But unfortunately, Splay never deallocates its objects. So if you tune your garbage collector to run Splay well, you'll have a whole other set of issues. Okay. Let's look at type. So now we're going to take the heap and we're going to break it down into what types of objects are on the heap. And this is a fairly complicated figure. Again, we have the benchmarks. We have heap data by type. So this is it by color. Number of different types. The most important types are circled here. And we see objects as one of them. So when we say objects, we don't mean a particular class of object. Objects in JavaScript are basically, it's a prototype-based language. So we're just talking about instances of any type. And then strings is a separate type, arrays, and then script functions. So script functions is the data allocated for code, essentially. And we see that these, in all cases, these really dominate the total amount of memory allocated. And one thing I want to point out here is that of the benchmarks, if you recall from the previous slide, only a small set of those actually allocated much data at all. So you're looking at a lot of benchmarks that allocate almost nothing. Of the ones that do allocate data, for example, regexp and string tag cloud, what you see here is that they're almost entirely strings. So not only are these, there are very few of these things that allocate a lot of data, the ones that do allocate data are quite unrepresentative in the data they allocate. If you look at the real web applications, they're actually quite similar to each other, which is one of the conclusions we reached from the paper. And in fact, the mix is quite similar. So in particular, many of these web applications allocate a significant fraction of the total allocation is code, functions and code. And then the next big chunk of allocation is actually strings. So JavaScript, unlike Java, almost everything it does, it's a glue language. Almost everything it does is construct strings, put them together, generate some new HTML, and present it, send it to the renderer. So basically, this is what you want to optimize your garbage collector for. Some of these applications do have a number of objects and object instances. Some would claim that in the future we'll probably see more and more of that kind of thing happening. They'll become sort of more like a traditional Java applications. But certainly what we're seeing right now is it very string intensive. If you want a garbage collector to work well, make it garbage collector strings. Okay, another result. One of the things you can do is look at the content of the heap over time and how it varies. Okay, so what we're seeing here is one application, Gmail, and we're looking at time in a logical measure, which is in terms of bytes allocated. So as we allocate more data, time moves forward this way. And we're seeing the contribution to the live heap of the different data types. So we've zeroed in on the four top data types I showed before, functions, strings, arrays, and objects. And what we can see here is that, you know, for example, the blue line, the number of functions in the heap increases. Now, sometimes things decrease. So in this case, the strings drop down dramatically. And that happens when a garbage collection occurs. So those objects are no longer participating in the heap. They've been identified as garbage and reclaimed. But one important takeaway here is that, in fact, the code grows almost monotonically. So basically, once you have code, it's there forever. Surprisingly, in Gmail at least, the objects also grow monotonically. So you don't garbage collect those objects. When you create objects in this particular application, they stay around forever. So again, if you focus your garbage collector on and reclaiming all those objects that you think are garbage, it's going to be a waste of time in Gmail. Okay, so this is another interesting insight that differs from Java. Here's eBay, a very different application. It gives us some other insights. eBay, this is the same exact graph, logical time on the x-axis and size of the live heap. One of the things, like Gmail, the functions dominate the heap in many cases. So in this case, you can see the biggest component of the heap almost all the time are the functions. Another important takeaway here is, and we measured across page loads, that the heap goes down to zero frequently. Okay, that when you reload a page, or click on a link and go to the next page, you basically zero out the whole JavaScript heap essentially, and you have to build it all from scratch. So you have to generate all the data again, all the functions. And in fact, here's an example in eBay where you're doing this repeatedly, and you're getting almost exactly the same heap. Now we don't have the measurements that show you that, but the shapes of these curves are going to tell you, yeah, the set of functions being collected, you know, being allocated and collected here is very similar across page reloads. And so what you're finding is you're doing a tremendous amount of recomputation on something that's almost identical to what you had just a second ago. So there's a couple important takeaways. One is, you know, you'll never see this happen in Java. You know, Java programs start up, they run for a while, and then they stop. Here, you basically very frequently are creating a new heap, populating it, doing a lot of work in terms of functions, et cetera, and then throwing the whole thing away. And the next one you build might be almost identical to the one you just built. We see evidence now that V8, and maybe somebody here from Google can talk to this. We see evidence now that Google is jitting and caching functions across page reloads. So, for example, all this code here, if they did a jitting once on it, the next time they load that same page or something similar, they're going to actually not have to rejit it, which makes a lot of sense. Okay, so here's another result. This is just to give you a flavor for how websites are different. Here's two web search websites. They offer very, very similar functionality, Bing and Google. In fact, the sequence of actions we did on both was identical in terms of looking things up. You see they're very, very different in the way they're implemented. So Bing, essentially, with Bing, you load the code and it stays around through the whole interaction. So this is a sequence of searches and a sequence of clicks through to various capabilities inside Bing. And the code accumulates. You see some garbage collecting going on. But ultimately, the heap is quite large, or relatively large compared to Google. With the same set of actions in Google, we see the heap is kept very small. There is recomputation. So we see that same behavior we saw in eBay. I guess it was, eBay. And in fact, they've taken a different approach. They've taken a much more, you know, we're going to go with a minimal overhead. But in fact, they won't have as much state. If you look at the amount of code here present in Bing in any given time, there's a lot of functionality here. So if you go to Bing and you use it for a period of time, you're going to get the benefit of all that code actually being available. Wow. Okay. Okay. I'm going to go quick. What we have now, we have some measurements on event handlers. One of the important takeaways with event handlers is that JavaScript is an event-driven programming model, so almost everything you do in JavaScript is handling some kind of event, either asynchronous or user events, on-click, et cetera. This is very different. The whole behavior of real web applications is totally different than a benchmark, where you start the benchmark, you run for, you know, whatever, 5 minutes, and then you're done. And in fact, the design of these websites is such that responsiveness to these events, especially user-level events, is actually a critical part of the design of the website. So in particular, and this is kind of a surprise again, the number of events handled in these applications, real websites, is on the order of hundreds to thousands. So in the case of Amazon, with this interaction, we get 6,000 individual events, almost none in V8, the same as SunSpider. If you look at the median number of bytecodes executed per event handled, you see quite a range. Some of the mapping websites actually have a fairly high overhead per event, partly because they're dealing with sort of large chunks of data. So these asynchronous requests that go out and bring down parts of your map, et cetera, are going to take some more execution. You can see the search engines, Bing, Google, have very low cost per event handled. Again, they're trying to minimize that delay. They're trying to increase responsiveness. Okay, so I'm almost done. You might be saying, well, sure, there's a lot of differences. Of course, we know that their benchmarks are different than real websites. How much difference does it make? So that's what we thought, too. And so we thought, well, maybe we'll do an experiment. And this is the cold code experiment. It's somewhat controversial, but I'll tell you about it anyway. The idea was the following. Real web applications have a lot of code, and a lot of it's cold. So what would happen if we took cold code and we added it to the SunSpider benchmarks? How would it affect the behavior of the benchmarks? And that's what we did. So we added code. The cold code never gets called. We just stick it in the file, and we see what happens. Okay. And this is the result. Here's Chrome. Here's IE8. We wanted to see if it's made differences across the browsers. In particular, what we show here is each grouping is a single benchmark, and the different color bars represent different amounts of cold code. So in the worst case, we added 2 megabytes of code to these benchmarks, which are literally 5 kilobytes each or something like that. So what happens is you can see there's a significant increase in the execution time of the benchmark as you add cold code. Well, that makes sense. There's a lot of processing. What doesn't make sense is how non-uniform some of the impact is. So in this case, 3D ray trace, you see you add 1 megabyte, it's not so bad. You add 2 megabytes, and you're in a totally different world, essentially. And of course, the impact is going to be different across the different browsers. Clearly IE8 is slower than Chrome in this case, so adding cold code is it going to have less of a relative impact? But fundamentally, the high level question you can ask is: if I tell you the SunSpider benchmark results for Chrome and IE8, and it says Chrome is 5 times faster than IE, how relevant is that in the context of these real web applications that typically have 2 megabytes of code? I think the important takeaway here is not that one browser is faster than the other. It's that we have to be very careful when we use benchmarks to think about what exactly they're telling us. Okay, so let me just get to a conclusion. The benchmarks are pointing to things like fast loops and small amounts of code, and they're telling us our JavaScript engines have to implement these things well. And in fact, that's not necessarily true, as we saw. And in addition, they're not telling us about things like garbage collection. They're not telling us about events. They're also not telling us about these contexts that are being reused between page loads. So this is a kind of a wake-up call to say, look, if you're building a JavaScript engine, think about these things. Let's see. So one last thing I want to take away from this is, in conclusion, okay, we build an instrumentation framework. We told you about how real websites are different than benchmarks. The next logical step is to say, well, what is a good benchmark? And in fact, we're currently working now on that problem. So our hope is that in the future, we will be able to give you something that looks a lot more like these real websites that we measured, but can be used in a framework as a benchmark that can be used to compare the performance of JavaScript engines. So, of course, there's other ways to take this work. You can build better JavaScript runtimes based on the real web applications and better tools as well to help expose this kind of information. So with that, I'll take questions.
I was wondering how you deal with anonymous functions, and specifically when you count the number of unique functions. Does each closure count as one unique function?
If I remember correctly, so yeah, we do deal with anonymous functions, when we look at the total amount of code, we actually count the same function being loaded multiple times, because it happens sometimes, especially across page loads. That's why we had that thing that said unique, static, unique functions. So we have a way to basically distinguish between two functions that are the same and different. And I think it's based on some kind of hash of the content of the function.
Do you think libraries overuse anonymous functions and sort of create leaky closures that encapsulate too much of the page that can't be
That's more than I could tell you based on the studies we did. I think, do they overuse anonymous? That's a part. Sorry, I can't answer.
Do you see any changes in, in line with the theme of the conference, do you see any changes in the way JavaScript is going or in replacements and how this stuff would affect that?
Right, great question. So I do think, and a lot of people have talked to us, you know, one of the issues that you can raise with this paper is say, well, we measured the most popular web applications as of last summer or last year. Well, you know, it's a moving target. So what do they look like now? How are they different? I think, I think you see there's more code on some of these websites now doing more interesting things. So a couple conclusions. One is I don't think the amount of code is going to shrink. I think it's going to get more and more. So that's one thing. Dealing with all that code is an important problem. But how dynamic they are and how much they reuse the code, I think that will change. And I think one argument you can make is that this is still the infancy. In fact, over time, what will happen is these applications will evolve to look a lot more like a Java application. I don't know if I believe that. I think there's still, as we see with Google, Google does not take, you can think of the Bing Google thing as a web 1.0 versus web 2.0, right? Bing is sort of, it's an application. It's got all that stuff there. But in fact, Google has chosen, for whatever reason, to have those page reloads to basically keep their memory footprint really small to use as little code as possible. That's a personal choice, and who knows whether that will continue to be the case, but I suspect that you'll always have both worlds.
Hey, Ben. So there's JavaScript code that's written by humans, mm-hmm. and probably a lot of the real apps you looked at are in that category. But there's also a number of frameworks. I'm a Rails partisan, but there are many others
right.
where the framework has a bunch of support for expressing something in the framework's way and having it generate JavaScript on the fly. So in those cases, the JavaScript's being auto-generated by something else, not being written by a human.
Right.
Based on what you guys found, what would you advise the people to do who are the authors of those code generation modules?
The frameworks, basically?
Well, what should framework writers be doing to make the world better for JavaScript and JavaScript execution engines?
Huh. So I think the amount of code in the framework is going to affect performance. So basically, and we're seeing more and more code. So at some level, for example, if you've got multiple components that load the same or different versions of the same exact JavaScript framework into a web page, that's going to be a problem. I mean, it's going to especially if they get bigger and bigger. So one of the directions to take this work is to say, why are we downloading all this code that's never getting executed? Okay, and can we stage the download? So this actually, my colleague Ben Lifshitz has presented papers on Deloto, which is a way to basically only download the code that actually is being used and to lazily download the rest of the code as needed. So I think those are the kind of mechanisms that will allow these frameworks to be reused, to be sort of used in the most efficient way. And I think in the long run, that's going to be an important part of making these web applications as responsive as possible.
My question ties to what you were just talking to, but let's see if there's anything more to be said. You spoke a lot about improving benchmarks to better measure how websites are actually using the browser. Did you have any other insights in how web applications can be more efficient in using the browser, how they can be written better, not just in the automated fashion?
So that goes to the issue of tools. I think there's one of the things that our work I think illustrates is that it really is useful to expose information about what's going on in the application to the developer. Okay, so we wrote we wrote this custom instrumentation of IE to get this data out, and in fact the tool space around performance tools for web applications has been improving. Certainly, Chrome, IE, Firefox have better better tools for profiling, et cetera. They don't necessarily focus on some of the things that we looked at. So, for example, what the heap looks like, whether you're leaking certain things in the heap, whether your heap structures are bigger than you thought, may not be exposed. But I think over time those kind of tools will develop and become available. Certainly, I do think that what we built wasn't really that complicated. It didn't take that long, and we certainly found some insights looking at real websites that helped us understand why they performed badly based on this kind of view. Whether or not the developers could have fixed those problems with the existing tools or whether they need better tools is an open question, but certainly you do need to know what's going on to make your application run well.
Are your modifications to IE8 available, and do
you feel it'd be useful? It was an internship project, so we're certainly not redistributing them. I think the way to think about that is that the IE team, you know, continues to think about performance tools, understanding what the needs are, and in fact, you'll see, you know, I think in the IE9 implementation, you'll see not necessarily these tools, but tools that are valuable for developers.
Thank you.